This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avidar, in for Allison Stewart. And to close out today's show, we're going to revisit a conversation I had with novelist Eden Lapucky. Her latest book, Time's Mouth, is the story of one family with a secret gift. The family's matriarch, Ursa, knew from an early age that she could time travel and relive a moment as if she were actually there. She's able to hone her ability, but it comes at a cost. Eventually, her own son, named Adam, flees their secluded home in the forests of Santa Cruz to seek out a new life in Los Angeles. Here's the thing. The baggage we carry from our past isn't so easily put down. And as insidious pain passes from one generation to the next, Adam's daughter, Opal, decides that the only way to heal is to visit her own past, to reveal the shrouded secrets of her legacy. Eden Lapucky weaves a saga that spans from 1950s San Francisco to the forests of Santa Cruz to the boulevards of Los Angeles in the 1990s. And along the way, the New York Times bestselling author examines the joy, the danger, the humanity of trying to hold on to the times we've lost, even when it would appear that time is in our control. I started by asking Eden where she was when the inspiration for this story first struck her.
My second child, my daughter, had just been born. And I think any parent who has more than one child knows this feeling of the next kid comes out and they just are immediately different from the previous one. And I have three kids now, and they all were just perfectly themselves from the moment I saw them. And when my daughter was born, she had these big blue eyes, and she just looked at me like, hey, I have got your number. And I thought, oh, wow, this person's very different. And then I thought, I mean, because I was in a sort of postpartum cloud, I thought, maybe she's magical. And I thought, maybe I should write a book about a magical baby. And that is a very... It's not the starting point for the book that you have now, which is about traveling back in time, but it definitely touches on this notion of the supernatural and these things we can't quite explain that we feel in very intense moments.
How did time travel come to be then?
Well, that was the second thing that came. I think every novel has a kind of constellation of origin stories that finally they all come together, and then you have the book and you're ready to write it. Oddly, this is a story told out of order, as maybe is appropriate, but yeah. When my first child was born, the author Ben Fountain, who's one of my favorite writers, you know, he has older kids, and he said, I wouldn't want to go back in time and do it again, but if I could just for a moment sit with my kid on the couch when he was in preschool, I would do it in a minute. And I remember at the time thinking, I don't really know what you're talking about, except I think we all want to go back in time. You know, I would kill to go back to college. But as my children age, and as I age, and I see them grow from newborn to infant to toddler to kid to preteen, I feel that desire to go back in time. So it was sort of like two ideas colliding. So it wasn't until I thought, what if I had a magical baby, that I remembered what Ben told me so many years before that. And I put them in my soupy writer's mind and blended them up in some way, and out came, oh, I'll write a time travel novel. Here we go.
And that's what came out of the Vitamix, yes, or whatever. When you think about that process for your writing, if you imagine it as maybe a pie chart, and you think about like, oh, this much of the pie chart goes to research, this much goes to writing, this much goes to editing, this much goes to just pontification.
Crying
right. What part of the pie chart is the biggest?
I would say daydreaming for me. I'm not a very research-oriented writer typically. It's not really what gets the engine revving. I will do just enough to get the information I need. But I spend a lot of time just sort of cogitating on people and places. And just kind of, before I start a book, kind of just like carrying an idea in my pocket, a person in my mind. And as I'm working, what I'm really doing a lot of the time is imagining deeply. Like my first book, California, it's a post-apocalyptic book. People said, oh, did you do a lot of research about, you know, going back to the land? And I said, no, I don't even go camping. And in this book, people want to know, oh, did you do a lot of research in 1950s San Francisco, where my character Ursa starts her journey as a, you know, nascent cult leader? And I say, I did just enough to be able to imagine where she would go. But what I mostly did was daydream about it and just kind of for, you know, like the young say, kind of like vibe with it for a while.
When you're vibing with it, do you feel like you already know where you want the ending to go? Or is that something that like the vibe shakes out?
It's different with every book. With this book, I really wanted to have a happy ending. Mm. I don't know why, but I felt like I just knew in my heart that they would be happy in the end after all of the things I knew I was going to put them through. But I didn't really know what was going to happen on the way there. And the book changed dramatically in various drafts. And I don't typically know. I mean, this is why it changes dramatically, is that I don't plan ahead very much. I sort of have to write it and feel it and see how a scene changes the characters to know what scene's going to happen next. And that kind of keeps me excited in the project.
You know what I think is super interesting right now? You say the origin of this book came from looking at your child. And then you said, I knew I wanted to have this be a happy ending. I'm not sure why. Do you think there's any connection there?
Probably. I wonder. I mean, I feel like maybe parenthood has made me more desirous of a happy ending, you know, wanting parents and children to ultimately connect. And maybe when I was just a daughter, I was willing to just say, oh, I don't need that.
Right.
But now that I'm the mom, I want that for everybody.
Has there ever been a moment where you thought, oh, I want this to be a sad ending? Like, that's what I'm going for.
I mean, my work can skew dark. I think that's because I'm not afraid to have complicated characters doing things that I wouldn't necessarily or hopefully not do in real life. So sometimes that does bring in something that's unhappy and hard to bear. I don't think either my other two books, I wouldn't describe them as having happy endings in the traditional sense. This one definitely has a more straightforward happy ending.
And
I wanted that satisfying feeling that you get from certain books where you're like, ah, things were resolved in a way that feels emotionally true and good. Like, I wanted that.
Is that what creates that satisfying ending?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think a happy ending that feels false is just a book that you throw across the room and you're like, this is not authentic. I think a true happy ending is one where it feels right. It feels like the characters would do those things. And you feel comforted by what they do in the end.
I hear earned in there as well.
Earned. I have a joke that when I die on my tombstone, I will say she earned her ending.
Oh, wow.
So, take note, husband.
Copyright children. That. I might steal that. you had mentioned climate change, or I'm not climate change. That's where I'm going with it. You had mentioned California before as being, you know, a place where you don't do a ton of research, but you've lived in California for a while. And in this book, it plays a central character itself. As you think about how you're writing about California in the future, or as you went through this book, there's so much related to climate change in California now. Does that influence the way you're thinking about future stories or anything about this one that you wrote?
Sadly, I think no matter where you're living, we're finding nowhere is untouched by climate change. I do think California has been at the head of that discussion because we're ahead of, for all things, sprouts on your sandwich, sure, certain kinds of shoes, you know, certain ideas about healing. So, I mean, I live in a place that I had to leave early. I had to leave my city early because there was a hurricane and there was also an earthquake on the same day. And there are always fires. But, you know, there are fires everywhere now. It is certainly, it's a topic that I feel like has to be present in any work that takes place in a contemporary era. And I'm also from a highly mythologized place, just like New York is. I don't think you can write about New York or California without kind of coming to terms with the many ideas we have about that place. So I've been thinking, I thought about it a lot when I was writing Time's Mouth, thinking about these are places that people have heard of before. And these people are, you know, two young lovers fleeing a commune to come to LA in the 80s, even they have a preconceived idea about what LA is.
Right.
And so when I think about now writing about climate change and California, I'm thinking a lot about how those mythologies are sort of part of the problem of how we ended up in a world that's so kind of desiccated. All these people coming to a place, you know, it's not sustainable.
Another thing that readers might notice in this book is how elements of behavior echo through generations. I'm not going to ruin anything, but there's this one element of how you heal, and you'll see there's different approaches, but like the same idea. Do you think we are all destined to be our parents?
Yes and no. I mean, I think everybody who was, you know, lucky or unlucky to be raised by their parents, depending on what your parents were like, you will hear your parents in your own parenting. Mm. Like, the sometimes when I speak to my children, I hear my mom, I hear my dad. I'm kind of obsessed with how we're parented prepares us or doesn't for life. And I feel so privileged to have parents that were really present in my life. And my mom was such a present mom, and my dad was such a present dad. And that has helped me be successful in having intimate relationships later. And so I think that's an obsession that will continue. In the book, there's characters who do all kinds of wackadoo stuff. Some people are going back in time to solve their, you know, heal their pain. One character is doing a therapy called Reikian therapy that actually my dad does, where he goes into a room and gags and screams into a pillow and wants so badly to heal himself without talking about what happened to him. He wants the physical release to bring the emotional release. And, you know, I don't think anybody would go to therapy if they thought none of that worked, of any kind of therapy. I think there is some chance to reject what isn't working for you, and to find new rituals and new ways of feeling happy.
The fact that you mention your dad makes me think of the role of mothers versus fathers, or just men versus women, or the gender lines that you talk or you hint at in the book. Specifically, the people with the power to travel back in time seem to be drawn along gender. Was that, can you talk that comes from?
Yeah, I did a really fun book club visit last night, and they were asking me about this, and I was joking that the writer is the stupidest person about their own book. And I say that because when I'm writing, I'm just trying to be with their characters and let them do what they're going to do and follow them. And I try not to, think too hard about why I'm making certain choices until later. And so I didn't set up to write a book about women and their inherited ability to time travel. It's not them having a female body that allows them to do this. It does skip a generation. Maybe if Opal had been born a boy, would she be able to time travel? I don't know. However, because I don't tend to like a magical quality or a supernatural quality that doesn't feel rooted in the real, I really leaned into like bodily descriptions. So, you know, it's they're the yolky membrane of time, and it happens once a month. You know, Opal finds out she can do it when she's getting her, she's literally changing her tampon in her high school bathroom when she goes back in time by accident. And so I definitely leaned into that, although I didn't want to stop to think, what does this mean? What am I trying to say? Because I like the idea of letting the reader tell me what I meant.
Right.
So you tell me, what did I mean to say?
You know, that sometimes we don't control the hand that we're given, maybe.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good one.
Thanks. I just made it up.
Good. I love it.
But it's true. It does feel true. You talked about that time, the way that you described it, the way that you came up with it must be interesting too. It is a very elegant version of time travel, especially when you think about all the difference of all the different ways we talk about time travel. But it's also very visceral. How'd you come up with that approach to time travel?
Thank you. I like being thought of as elegant in some way in my life, because I'm kind of klutzy. I wanted to make the time travel, it's definitely real. It's not just they're having memories. There's actually a haunting of their own memory. I think it just came from a natural desire of when I've kind of like gone on a reverie about, you know, playing tetherball at my friend Annie's house in elementary school and really tried to conjure hitting that yellow ball and the sound of it against the metal pole and where we were. And I will do almost like a fiction work of imagining the scene. And so I thought, well, what if you kind of imagined it and you could really go there? And I didn't want to have anything super sci-fi because I didn't think I would write it very well. I wanted to keep it with the body. I'm really interested in how it feels to have a body. I feel like there just isn't enough fiction about something that we all have. We all have these meat sacks that we're carrying around, and some people's bodies are more vulnerable than other people's bodies, and some people's bodies are commented on and some aren't. But everybody has a very personal relationship to their body. And if you're writing fiction where you're getting into how people feel and you're exploring consciousness, then you have to talk about the body too. And I thought that is what will make the time travel feel real if it is connected to the body.
many people also gravitate towards it over time.
Yes.
In the book.
There, Ursa, who's the first time traveler, she, in a, through a series of events that you will read about when you purchase the book, ends up in Santa Cruz in this mansion, and women flock to her because when she time travels, she's more powerful than Opal. She emits some kind of euphoric feeling, and they want, it's like a drug. They want to be around her, and they're always sick afterwards, as you might be if you do heroin and then you don't do it again. You have like withdrawal symptoms. And I did that so that there was a real world consequence of the time travel.
Hmm.
And because I thought if they don't feel good, they're not going to want to hang out with Ursa, all ladies in the middle of nowhere and being forced to like cultivate marijuana and make their own porridge or whatever you have to do in, when you're a hippie. so I like the idea of the time travel being its own attraction.
Right, right. Time travel being its own attraction also made me wonder while I was reading the book how you would have used that power if you had it. You had mentioned, you know, 15 minutes ago going back to college, but
yeah, there's a couple things. I mean, I have three kids, as I've said like three times. In the middle of writing this book, I had my third child. I claim I'm not a hippie, but he was born at home. I was also born at home. And there was a moment when I pulled him out of me. Can I say that on the radio? And put him on my chest. And I had those, you know, those birth hormones that they always talk about. And I was just, talk about bliss. I mean, and he wasn't crying. He was fine, but I was worried. But he was such a peaceful baby. He's still a pretty chill guy. That's where I would go. I would really go to that moment. Because it was really, truly a blissful moment of, after all this horrible pain, and now this beautiful baby's here, and he'll never be that size again.
Right. And it's interesting that the memory you choose is one that has both pain and joy in it.
I know. Isn't that such like a novelist?
That's such a novelist answer. That's a great answer.
But actually, in the future, I'm going to go back in time to this moment when I'm on NPR at WNYC.
That's the right answer. Yeah, that's what we're looking for. Now we can wrap it.
That was my conversation with Eden Lopucky. She is the author of the book Time's Mouth. And that's all of it for today. All of it is produced by Andrea Duncan Mao, Kate Hines, Jordan Loff, Simon Close, Zach Goddard Cohen, L. Malik Anderson, Luke Green, and Aki Camargo. Megan Ryan is the head of live radio. Our engineers are Juliana Fonda and Jason Isaac. Luscious Jackson does our music. I'm Kushan Avidar. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you. And I will meet you back here next time.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.